In our lesson today, we're going to read from the book The Jewish Choice, Unity or Anti-Semitism. We're reading chapter 3 of the book. You're invited to send questions to our website, kav.tv, selected questions will be asked here. Jewish Choice, Unity or Anti-Semitism.
It's not that related to the chapter that we're going to read now, but we have to try and see whether our perception of reality changes. Are we starting to more correctly understand what's going on? Are we better differentiating things according to spiritual definitions instead of corporeal ones? By corporeal definitions, we're all from the Kli of Adam HaRishon, the broken Kli that was broken to begin with. That otherwise it is impossible to reveal the evil inclination, and I've revealed the evil inclination comes actually as a result or from the preparation, the shattering, and from the shattering and on, we talk about the development of reality toward adhesion with the Creator, and then in that development we always have a part that is in the direction of reaching this development, that's in some kind of search, consciously or unconsciously. Even those that evolve in the direction which is not yet spiritual, but still, they're drawn to revealing the meaning of life, the purpose of life, corporeally wise, egoistically. Still, all that is called Yashar Kel. Depends on what level, the still, vegetative, animate, or the speaking level in a person. This is how they develop. And those in which the Rishimot have not awoken yet, like we see that it is in the majority of the world, then they're still developing corporeally. They're on hold, so to speak. They're advancing corporeally, and so it is preferable for us to see reality spiritually, meaning as a single system, and those that are already drawn by the Rishimot, well, not themselves, it's by the Rishimot in them. Still, it awakens the light that comes from above. So there are those that awaken and those that don't. And the entire matter is how we that are in that part that is awakening towards self-correction, how this part awakens the others. That this is actually our work. To hasten the entire world as much as possible to reach the purpose of creation. So, the more we read and learn about the nations of the world, history, geography, to nonetheless envision, depict it, to attribute it, related to the soul of Adam HaRishon. Because there's no history, there's no geography, there's no world, there's no nothing. There's only the one broken soul, and the way that it unites nonetheless by hastening or in due time toward connection. Please.
We are reading the third chapter from The Jewish Choice, Unity or Anti-Semitism. Chapter 3, From the Zenith to the Nadir. Headline, Helen the Siren, the allure of Hellenism and its horrific fallouts. The enchantment of Ptolemy with Jewish wisdom was the heyday of the era of the Second Temple, which lasted from the people of Israel's return to their land in 516 BCE to 70 CE, when Emperor Vespasian's son and chief of staff, Titus Flavius Vespasianus, marched into Jerusalem with an army led by his regional commander, the Jew-turned-genocidal anti-Semite Tiberius Julius Alexander. From the height of Ptolemy's reverence for the Jews, the carriers of the light for the nations began a rapid social, moral, and spiritual degeneration that bred two civil wars and ended with the Armageddon of razing the Second Temple, the slaughter of 1 million Jews, and enslavement of the famished and emotionally flustered relics of the Jewish people. From being a role model for the nations, it took the Jews less than 80 years to become embroiled in the first of two civil wars. Today we call this war the Hasmonean Revolt and celebrate Hanukkah to commemorate our victory over the Greeks. But in truth, the events were far less festive than the current narrative surrounding the festival of Hanukkah. Judea was a strategic point between the Seleucid Empire and the Egyptian Empire, both of which were Hellenistic. During the reign of Antiochus III, the Great, Judea was ruled by the Seleucid Empire but enjoyed almost complete autonomy. The Jews could lead their lives however they chose, as long as they paid their taxes to the king. In fact, Antiochus the Great was grateful to the Jews for helping him in his war against Ptolemy IV, Philopator, and his son, Ptolemy V, Epiphanes, and considered it his duty to guard the autonomy of the Jews. To show his appreciation for their assistance and his reverence for their way of life, Antiochus wrote a formal letter permitting the Jews to live according to their ways. He wrote, "On account of their piety toward God, he decided to bestow on them as a pension for their temple work 20,000 pieces of silver, in addition to abundance of fine flour, wheat, and salt." When Antiochus III the Great died, his firstborn son Seleucus IV, Philopator, succeeded him. Seleucus Philopator kept the status quo with the Jews, who continued to live untroubled in Judea. In 175 BCE, Seleucus IV Philopator died, and Antiochus IV Epiphanes succeeded him. Initially, Antiochus Epiphanes had no intention to change the status quo in Judea, but some Jews had other plans, and from here, matters quickly went downhill. By the time Epiphanes came to power, many Jews were already displeased with the Jewish traditional way of life. All around the kingdom of Judea, writes Paul Johnson, cities were becoming Hellenized. It happened in Shechem, in Marissa, Philadelphia, which is Amman, and Gamal across the Jordan. Eventually, a ring of such cities, swarming with Greeks and semi-Greeks, surrounded Jewish Samaria and Judea, which were seen as mountainous, rural, and backwards. Antique survivors, anachronisms, soon to be swept away by the irresistible modern tide of Hellenic ideas and institutions. Seeing what was happening around them, the Jews established what Johnson called a Jewish Reform Party, who wanted to force the pace of Hellenization in Judea. Just as the contemporary Reform movement that started in Germany strove to strip Judaism of Jewish customs, or at least to mitigate them, and place the focus on its ethics, their forefathers strove to reduce it to its ethical core. To accelerate the Hellenization of Judea, the leader of the archetypal Reform movement, Yasson, whose goals and modus operandi were very similar to today's Reform Judaism, joined hands with King Antiochus Epiphanes, who was anxious to speed up the Hellenization of his dominions because he thought it would raise tax revenues, as he was chronically short of money for his wars. Yasson paid Epiphanes a hefty sum of money, and in return, the latter ousted the incumbent high priest in Jerusalem, Onias III, and handed the position over to Yasson. Yasson went to work straight away. He turned Jerusalem into a polis, renamed it Antiochia, and constructed a gymnasium at the foot of Temple Mount. Just as the Reform movement did in Germany as soon as they were given emancipation in the early 1870s, the reformers in antiquity aspired to adapt Judaism to modernity, eventually abandoning it altogether. Besides making Jerusalem more like the capital of the Seleucid Empire, Seleucia, they abandoned ancient Jewish customs that related to the temple and stopped circumcising male babies. In the words of Flavius Josephus, they left off all the customs that belonged to their own country and imitated the practices of the other nations. But far worse than the abandonment of their customs, when the Jews turned Hellenists, they also abandoned their unity. Even among the Hellenists, fights erupted between supporters of Yasson.
ומאנטיוכוס השלישי הגדול לא רצו באף לא אחד משני המנהיגים והתחילו להתמרד יותר ויותר. בשנת 170 לפני הספירה עשה מנלאוס ליאסון בדיוק את מה שעשה לפניו לאוניאס.
In 170 BC, מנלאוס did to Jason just what he had done to Onias III before him. He paid Antiochus Epiphanes a hefty sum of money, who in turn anointed him the high priest in Jerusalem. A year or so later, Yasson and his supporters tried to retake the priesthood, but with the help of Antiochus Manelus, who was even more pro-Greek than Yasson, managed to maintain his position. Yet Antiochus Epiphanes helped cost the Jews heavily. On his way back from a failed campaign against the Egyptian pharaoh Ptolemy Epiphanes, entered Jerusalem without a struggle, pretending to come in peace for his supporters, the Menelaus camp, but once inside, he spared not so much as those that admitted him into it. After slaying its people and plundering the city and the temple of all the wealth, including even the temple veils, Antiochus forbade them to offer those daily sacrifices, build an idol altar upon God's altar, and slew swine upon it. To see that the Jews did not rebel against him, Antiochus placed a guard made of impious and wicked Jews who inflicted on the residents many and sore calamities. Interestingly, Epiphanes himself was not interested in obliterating Judaism. In fact, it was most unusual for a Greek government to trample other faiths. According to Johnson, the evidence suggests that the initiative came from the extreme Jewish reformers led by Menelaus. Yet, in 167 BCE, when the Hellenists tried to place an idol in the temple at Modi'in, where Matityahu the Hashmonai was the priest, the tide turned against them. The first book of Maccabees conveniently regards Antiochus IV Epiphanes as the villain in the story, describing him as the wicked root, Antiochus surnamed Epiphanes. Epiphanes certainly earned his reputation in his infamous 167 BCE Antiochus' decree. He wrote to his whole kingdom that all should be one people and everyone should leave his laws, so all the heathen agreed according to the commandment of the king. Moreover, many of the Israelites consented to his religion and sacrificed unto idols. But foreign leaders were never our worst enemy. Those have always come from within, and through their misdeeds they brought upon us our most painful blows. In the case of Antiochus Epiphanes, we must not forget that it was Jason who first enticed him to force Hellenism on the Judean Jews, and his successor, Menelaus, dragged him into the war against the Maccabees. The second book of the Maccabees describes Menelaus as increasing in malice and being a great traitor to the citizens. As mentioned above, he dethroned Jason from the priesthood by buying his position from Epiphanes. Yet he did not settle for being the high priest at the temple. He truly wanted to make Hellenism the ruling culture and religion in Judea. To achieve this, writes Josephus, the Hellenists began to place idols inside Jewish temples all over Judea and forced the Jews to bow before them and sacrifice to them. One particular temple of interest to the Hellenists was the one in Modi'in, an important city not very far from Jerusalem, whose priest, Matityahu the Hashmonai, was renowned, well-respected, and very adamant about his piousness. The Hellenists wanted to compel the Jews to do what they were commanded and to enjoin those that were there to offer sacrifice. They desired that Matityahu, a person of the greatest character, would begin the sacrifice because, they believed, his fellow citizens would follow his example. Matityahu also saw a thought, and precisely because he too believed that they would follow his example, he did the exact opposite of what the Hellenists expected. Matityahu said he would not do it, and that if all the other nations would obey the commandments, the commands of Antiochus, neither he nor his sons would leave the religious worship of their country. When another Jew stepped into the sacrifice instead of Matityahu, the enraged priest ran upon the Jew with his sons, who had swords with them, and slew both the man who sacrificed and Apelles, the king's general, who compelled them to sacrifice with a few of his soldiers. When he was done with their enemies, Matityahu turned to the crowd and called out, "Anyone who is zealous for the laws of his country, let him follow me." Before long, thousands of Jews, frustrated with the forced conversion into Hellenism dealt on them by the high priest himself, joined Matityahu and headed for the mountains of Judea's desert. Matityahu appointed his third son, Judah Maccabee, as commander of the new hatched militia, And from the desert, they conducted the guerrilla, the brilliant guerrilla campaign that we know now as the Hashmonaim revolt, or as a Maccabi revolt. The Maccabean revolt did not target the Seleucid army or any of the neighboring armies. It aimed the Hellenized Jews and strove to intimidate them and force them back to Judaism. But since the Hellenists had the support of the Seleucid government, they turned to Antiochus and asked for his military assistance. Matityahu, writes Josephus, got a great army around him. He overthrew their idol altar and slew those who broke the laws, even all whom he could get under his power, for many of them were dispersed among the nations round about them for fear of him. 1 year into the revolt, Matityahu passed away. Before his death, he summoned his sons and instructed how they should continue the struggle. But most of all, he commanded them to maintain their unity according to the ancient Jewish law. I exhort you especially to agree one with another, and in what excellency any one of you exceeds another, to yield to him so far, and by that means to reap the advantage of everyone's own virtues. It is this spirit of unity and contribution of everyone's strength to the common good that yielded the Maccabees their illustrious victory over the far greater, better equipped, and far better trained armies of Seleucid Empire. 3 years into the revolt, Judah was strong enough to march on Jerusalem and retake it from the Seleucim. They finally, in 164 BCE, the high priest Menelaus was forced to seek refuge. As the Maccabees entered the temple, they found it deserted, its gates burned down, and plants growing in the temple of their own accord. On account of its desertion, the Maccabees brought in new vessels and candlesticks, and the altar, which were made of gold, hung up the veils at the gates and added doors to them. He also took down the altar and built a new one. So on the 5th of 20th day of the month of Kislev, they lit the lamps and were on the candlestick offered incense upon the altar and burned offerings upon the new altar. To this day, we celebrate this occasion and call this festival Hanukkah. Yet retaking Jerusalem and resuming the worship in the temple did not end the war. Not only did the Jews have to fight the Seleucids outside the walls, they also had trouble from within. Throughout the period of persecution and revolt, writes historian Lawrence H. Schiffman, the Hellenistic pagans in the land of Israel had sided with the Seleucim and had participated in the persecution. It was therefore natural that Judah now turned on these enemies as well as on the Hellenizing Jews who had brought on the horrible persecutions. The Hellenizers, many of them of aristocratic origin, had fought on the side of the Seleucids against Judah. Their center was the Acre fortress within Jerusalem, and it was here that they finally took refuge when Judah conquered Jerusalem. After Antiochus IV died in 164 BCE, his son Antiochus V advanced on Judea. Continues Schiffman, some of the besieged Hellenists managed to sneak out at night, writes Josephus, and got to the new king Antiochus Epiphanes, who was only 9 when he succeeded his father. The fugitives lied to the child king asking him not to be neglected under the great hardships that lay upon them from those of their own nation, as they suffered on his father's account while they left the religious worship of their fathers and preferred that which he had commanded them to follow. This, of course, was completely false, since it was Yasun who initially approached Epiphanes and asked him to force Hellenism in Judea, contrary to the Seleucids, conducted everywhere else. The runaways also said that there was danger lest the... And those appointed to Gerizon, it by the king should be taken by Judas, unless he would send them assistance. As one might accept, the 9-year-old king fell for the trap and commanded to send a formidable army to Jerusalem. The Seleucids assembled about 100,000 footmen, 20,000 horsemen, and 32 elephants, and advanced on Jerusalem, conquering every city that came in their path. After putting a long siege on Jerusalem and having almost starved into death, the Seleucids suddenly found themselves under the threat from Persia. Having no other choice, the king offered the besieged Jerusalemites peace, promising the freedom of worship and self-governance. The Maccabees accepted the offer willingly, and the Seleucids quickly retreated to deal with the advancing Persians. They did, however, take with them the now ousted high priest Manelaus, as this man was the origin of all the mischiefs the Jews had done them, by persuading his father to compel the Jews to leave the religion of their fathers. I understand that some of you are asking yourselves, what do we need all of this for? But the atmosphere that the book wants to tell us about is in and of itself very important, because this is actually the atmosphere that is all the time persecuting us. It's not that it happened 2,000 years ago and disappeared, and we're studying history here. It's not history, even though that there are names here and places that are irrelevant. But the status between the forces and the entire situation did not change whatsoever. It's a wonder how all of these things, when they position themselves against these two forces, this entire atmosphere, the entire way these forces are set, it all continues to this day until the end of correction. Therefore, we should integrate with what it says here in order for us to feel that this isn't a history lesson, but that this is what we're experiencing right now, and to try and see in the modern state the same relationships. Please.
Heading, the rise and fall of the Hasmonean kingdom. Despite their victory, the Hasmonean did not translate their freedom into spiritual liberty. Instead, they focused on conquering land, forcing other nations to convert to Judaism, and gaining power and wealth. From the end of the revolt in 160 BCE to the end of their independence, the Hasmoneans increased their territory by more than 10 times. From a small region around Jerusalem, they conquered expansive territories from the Mediterranean Sea in the west to beyond the Jordan River on the east. From north to south, the Hasmonean kingdom spread from what is today's southern Lebanon and the Golan Heights in the north to today's Gaza Strip, included in the south, the length of several hundred kilometers. Despite their military might, their tendency to mingle with the nations and shun Jewish unity grew stronger every day. They may have defeated the Greeks and the Hellenists in battle, but in the battle over the spirit of the nation, the Israeli spirit was losing bitterly to the Hellenists within them. Gradually, Hellenism landed deadly blows on every field of life in the Hasmonean kingdom. Especially now, it was all the more evident that, as Paul Johnson put it, in self-government and prosperity, the Jews always seemed drawn to neighboring religions. As soon as things go well for them, they seem to forget their unique ability to forge unity above all differences, as they did at the foot of Mount Sinai, and opt out of it into individualistic and particularistic cultures that exalt the self. Moreover, the Jews became imperialistic themselves. Even worse, unlike the Greeks, who allowed the Jews freedom of worship, where the Hasmoneans conquered, they forced people to convert to Judaism under threat of murder or expulsion. This completely contradicts the spirit of Judaism, since Judaism is about connection, as one man with one heart, and connection of hearts cannot be forced. It is impossible to compel one to love others. By forcibly converting non-Jews, the Hasmoneans brought into their ranks myriad bogus Jews who were not reared on the principle of mutual responsibility and brotherly love, around which the nation was fashioned and consolidated. In doing so, they hastened the moral, spiritual, and eventually physical collapse of the nation and the country. Moreover, writes Johnson, in becoming rulers, kings, and conquerors, the Hasmoneans suffered the corruptions of power. Alexander Yanai, who ruled between 103 and 76 BCE, turned into a despot and a monster, and among his victims were the pious Jews from whom his family had once drawn its strength. Like any ruler in the Near East at that time, he was influenced by the predominant Greek modes. Using his position as the high priest and self-crowned king, Alexander the Hasmonean was exemplary in shunning traditional Jewish customs, and thus paved the way for the populace to abandon Judaism and adopt Hellenism. When observant Jews protested his contempt for Jewish traditions, he retaliated by slaying thousands of them. Alexander, in fact, concludes Johnson, found himself like his hated predecessors, Jason and Menelaus, de facto perpetuating the civil war. When Alexander Yanaios died in 76 BCE, his two sons, John Hyrcanus II and Aristobulus II, struggled between them over the supremacy. Yet Alexander committed the kingdom to Alexandra, Shlomtzion the king, Alexander's Yanai's wife and the son's mother. Alexandra preferred Hyrcanus the elder to Aristobulus, but regrettably for her, he was indeed unable to manage public affairs and delighted rather in a quiet life. Therefore, she made Hyrcanus high priest because he was the elder, but much more because he cared not to meddle with politics. Unlike his elder brother, Aristobulus was an active and a bold man who had his eyes on the crown. When Salome Alexandra died in 67 BCE, Aristobulus rebelled against his older brother and defeated him in a battle in Jericho. The triumphant Aristobulus declared himself king of Judah, but he had no interest in being the high priest and left Hyrcanus in his former position. However, regrettably for Aristobulus, his reign was to be very brief, cut short by the Romans. The gifted rulers of the Hasmonean house would probably have carried their arms still farther, observed the celebrated historian and archaeologist Theodor Mommsen, had not the development of the power of the remarkable conquering priestly state been nipped in the bud by internal divisions. Once again, this unity and internal hatred was to take its toll on the Jews. In 63 BCE, just 4 years after Aristobulus captured the crown, the Roman general Pompey the Great conquered Judah as part of a much larger campaign against Anatolia, also known as Asia Minor. This began the era of Roman rule in Judah and ended the era of Judah's independence. Perhaps Paul Johnson's concise and poignant conclusion best describes the rise and fall of the Hasmoneans' sovereignty in Judah. The story of their rise and fall is a memorable study in hubris. They began as the avengers of martyrs. They ended as religious oppressors themselves. They came to power at the head of an eager guerrilla band. They ended surrounded by mercenaries. Their kingdom, founded in faith, dissolved in impiety. Yet the Romans, like the Greeks before them, had no interest in forcing their beliefs or culture on the Jews. While they annexed Syria, they left Judea as a dependent, diminished temple state. While a heavier tribute was imposed on the Jews than on the other Syrian subjects of Rome to avenge their insurgency, it seems as though, on the whole, the Romans handed the Jews a great arrangement. A mighty empire protected them from enemies while leaving them free to lead their lives as they pleased. They could have lived peacefully and quietly under Rome's protection had it not been for the rulers of the state who arose from within their faith. Pompey did not oust Hyrcanus from his position and left him in office as the high priest until his death in the year 40 BCE. Pompey even declared Hyrcanus as the ethnarch of Judah, namely a ruler but with less authority than a king. Yet to guarantee Judah's loyalty to Rome, Pompey placed the real power of governance in the hands of Antipater First, the Edomian. Antipater, being the son of an Edomite who was forced to convert into Judaism, pledged his allegiance to his benefactors, the Romans, rather than to the kingdom of Judah. Antipater's rule marked the end of the dynasty of kings and rulers from the house of King David. His son, Herod, who reigned after him, completely Hellenized the country, building amphitheaters, gymnasiums, and entire cities such as Caesarea, that were completely Hellenistic. In the year 4 BCE, Herod died, and the Romans divided his kingdom among three of his sons and his sister. Herod Archelaus received the biggest portion and became ethnarch of the Tetrarchy of Judea at the early age of 18. The people glad of the death of the tyrant, write Gottfried and Ginsberg in the Jewish Encyclopedia concerning the death of Herod, were well disposed toward Archelaus. And in the public assembly in the temple, the new king promised to have regard to the wishes of his subjects. Unfortunately, it very soon became manifest how little he intended to keep his word. Archelaus's reign was fraught with political intrigue, broken promises, and frequent civil unrest. In 6 CE, after 10 tumultuous years, the Romans' patience had run out, and Archelaus was deprived of his crown and banished to Vienna in Gaul. Archelaus was a veritable Herodian, conclude Gothel and Ginsberg, but without the statesmanlike ability of his father. He was cruel and tyrannical, sensual in the extreme, a hypocrite and a plotter. It is therefore no wonder that after banishing Archelaus, the Romans declared Judah a province of Rome and changed its name to Judea. Heading, the Roman province Judea.
Any questions? Or we're finishing soon. Yeah?
Again and again. The posterior comes to the anti-Semites, but oftentimes we heard that there's no coercion in spirituality. What is anti-Semitism if not coercion from above?
They're the forces of nature, and we're part of them. That in free choice there have to be two opposite forces. So we, in between these two forces, have choice, free choice. You can't say about these two forces, why do they exist? You can only say that I have free choice, this is what was given to me, and what do I do about it? Either I want to be in favor of the Creator, and then it's against my ego, and this is what I choose, because this is the meaning of life, the purpose of creation, the correct development, or the other way around, if you have free choice. Maybe I didn't understand your question correctly at all.
At what point through our story we use our free choice.
Our free choice is only to unite. Only to unite in order to reach the correct state where all of us become as one man and one heart, adhere to the Creator. That's it.
But over and over, story after story that we hear,
when the pressure disperses,
all of reality revolves only around that, all of history. If you look at all the struggles in favor and against connection, unity, you'll see that this is the only thing leading the world throughout the historical axis.
Where's the middle line? When you don't need the negative pressure.
You have negative pressure from the ego all the time. And positive pressure you have from the Creator that also shows you problems in the ego, because you're all on the left side, on the side of the ego, on the side of the evil forces.
How to gather a nation to a point of balance, such a point of balance?
It's a balance.
What balance? You have no balance, point of balance. You're not reaching it. The point of balance is where you take your ego on the one side and the upper light on the other and put over them Tzimtzum Masach and Or Chozer and use these both forces correctly in balance. This is already a Paltzuf.
No, no.
The goal of creation, the purpose of creation.
Creation isn't to just like wipe people out and then comes unity. Wipe people out.
The purpose of creation is not to erase or to erase people. People aren't taken into consideration whatsoever. Human beings are not taken into consideration. What is are the two forces. And the main thing is the free choice between them. The Creator, He doesn't need this game. He needs the free choice in each and every given moment. What does everyone choose? And all of these choices, when they join together, the choice is what he needs. Are you choosing what he's giving you? And in each given moment, he's giving you, like you say, balance. He's giving you balance between the forces. Only you don't feel it. You do not accept it. If he breaches the balance from above, then that's called that the destroyer has received permission to act. But usually, we're balanced from above. This is what we're given, that we can't choose. This is our problem. But you're given the forces and the opportunity to come together to balance these forces correctly. Your eyes will be opened and you will see that you can't say that, hey, he didn't give me the opportunity. To the contrary, you were given an opportunity every given moment.
That's the point of this book, to give an opportunity to people to connect.
This book wants to explain to people that they have an opportunity to choose connection.
Connection or that kind of a result again and again.
If you don't choose,
it'll be the same.
Connection will be like this.
Nachon.
True.
So,
and this is how gradually, by way of suffering, they advance toward the goal by way of suffering. But were they to choose connection? What do we want? We want to convince ourselves and the rest of the world that it's good for us to choose connection because this is the law of nature. We have no choice. If we want to reach the purpose of creation in a good and nice way, even though that we're all in the last generation, but in the last generation, there's an opportunity that's open to everyone to correct ourselves in a good way. And if not, then we plunge into such problems that we never saw before. Like it says in the Prophet,
significant the intention behind people's connection. That's what I'm asking. People can connect to save their ass, you know, but not for the intention of giving contentment to the Creator. Giving contentment to the Creator is only relevant to us.
That's true. Correct.
Correct. Free choice begins from the lowest things. From the egoistic form of things and more and more and more. What do you think? We act out of the desire to give contentment to the Creator. We only talk about it. But actually, our inclination is to only do good to ourselves, consciously, subconsciously. Were you to think about the Creator, then you'd already be in the attainment of the upper world. You'd already see what you're doing in your own free choice, truthfully. You'd already act and see everything in the light of bestow, in the light of the forces of bestowal and not reception. You'd see the realm in front of you as as these two forces, and you would act with Tzimtzum, Masach, Ochozer, and so on. But here, in the meantime, you don't have that yet. We're all in order to receive. But this is also good, because we understand this is what the book wants to say. The book wants to tell everyone, not only the Jews. The Jews are those that are directed toward connection. They're considered Jews. It doesn't matter where that person's from in the world. If he's directed toward connection, he could be black, white, yellow, red, you name it, like Bala Sulam writes, no difference. The main thing is, if you're directed toward connection, you're a Jew. If not, you're not, especially now in the last generation. So this is what we want to explain, that before the crises that come now, and no one sees the future world as something good. Look what is written about 2020. Darkness. Real darkness. So we have to simply make things good. This is what the book talks about. The book talks about, let's connect as much as we can, and things will be good. No connection, things will be bad. That's the law of nature. Because nature is integral, global, connected on all sides, and only we on the inside that are most developed, the strongest, that we have the forces to make a difference, to influence nature. We influence nature in that direction in a bad way. So, sure, we'll suffer before everyone. This is what the book says. It's not religious. It's not secular. It's not nothing. It simply talks about the law of creation.
But it gives specific, it uses the fate of Jews again and again.
So, Jew means he who yearns for connection.
I understand.
There are no Jews or Gentiles. We've reached a state where only here in our world there is this, still this confusion. But everyone who understands the matter, that yearns for it, he's called a Jew, meaning who he who yearns for connection.
This book is very sharp, it's undeniable, it's acerbic, it's really to the point. However, how to broaden the scope a little bit so that humanity can picture themselves in the same fate as the Jews, the corporeal arrangement of the Jews, to look at this example and say, this could be all of us, will be gone.
Adon Cohen, ani maskim itcha
b'me'er. I 100% agree with you. But what I'm asking is, write. Write. This book is in English. You write in English too. You know English, right? Write in English. Very simple. What's the problem? To sit here and pa-pa-pa, to talk into the mic, won't give anything. Write. Only writing. And nothing else. This is what's left to do. And we'll be happy to help you.
What to write?
What you're talking about? You have many thoughts. And I'm not only turning to you, I'm turning to everyone. Write. Write. Even if it's not exactly so, or like this, or like that, write. We'll check what you're writing, and then we can publicize it on the net. That will collect the best essays, the most correct ones, and we'll make some kind of a book out of it. We'll turn it into a book. Why not? 20-30 people should write essays, each giving his own impression, his own angle of things, and turn it into a book. It'll make a difference. What Chaim wrote, I wrote, he wrote, it's not enough. Everyone has their own way. That's it. Let's do that. What do you want?
Hello, Rav. I also feel the book really strongly. Maybe in French.
Je pense que, Rav, je pense que le, je ressens que on doit enseigner ce livre-là.
אני מרגיש שאנחנו צריכים.
I feel that we need to study this book, to teach it to the whole world. I want to ask Rav, what do you think about it, teaching it?
I don't know. No patience. Look at the friends here. People don't have the patience to read, understand, inquire. The main thing for us is to get an impression. That's why I'm saying we all have to hear this. But to especially get an impression of how every time there was this struggle in favor and against connection and what happened as a result. That's it. And to reach the correct summary of things, the understanding of things, and even though that there are here friends that are waiting for when will all this end, it's not good. It's the breaking point, and therefore he explains it so broadly, in an extended way, because this is where you see the struggle in favor and against connection, where to this day, as a result of this struggle, we are in a shattered world. That's it. Now, I hope that the book will be publicized in all languages, and everyone will be able to understand that this, that connection is the salvation.
Today we have Facebook. Facebook is very strong. If you have a Facebook page, you can do Facebook Live and start.
Please go ahead.
That's what happened in Africa. That's what I did in Africa, and everyone can do it here. Each one can do a Facebook Live and start explaining this book.
Please. We have those that are responsible for publicity. Please, you're used to getting an order from me and you still don't get it, that I'm not giving any orders in this regard. This is your work. If you do it, you'll get something. If you don't, you won't. Just ask yourselves, why are we sitting on our butts and our head is still between our knees? Why is this still how we are and not with our head in the heaven? Because you're not awakening, stimulating yourself to awaken yourselves. And therefore, this is how it seems. This is how it looks. If you don't overcome this laziness, if you don't do something yourselves, then where can it come from? What does an awakening mean, overcoming, even corporeally wise?
I agree 100%, Rav.
I have nothing further to add.
No.
Last one. How come Rav focuses only on anti-Semitism
Because it's against connection.
One at night in France there's also a lot of anti-Semitism, maybe even more than the United States, but Rav is focusing on the United States. Why?
Because today this is the source of resistance in France. There is anti-Semitism without Jews. How many Jews do you have there? 500,000? What do you have?
No.
Half a million.
Yeah, it's nothing. In the United States you have 12 million. They say 7-8. It's 12.
No, it's something
completely different. And the Americans, this is where the French, they are idealistic anti-Semites. For them, it has to do with religion, and even though that it's a country that is very internally anti-Semitically oriented, but it's not for today. France is passé. Let's go.
We continue. The Roman province Judea. Between the year 6 CE and 66 CE, when the great revolt that destroyed Jerusalem and the temple broke out, no less than 15 Roman procurators governed in Jerusalem, sometimes for as briefly as 2 years. As one might expect, those years were far from tranquil. The first procurator, Coponius, was ousted after Samaritans threw about dead men's bodies into the temple. Valerius Cratus, who governed from 15 through 26 Common Era, the longest term, was the first to arbitrarily appoint and depose high priests. Following Cratus came Pontius Pilate. Pilate's term as procurator was filled with even more misdeeds than the already high level of offenses that Roman procurators had committed. Josephus writes that Pilate started off by placing images of Caesar that are called ensigns in the temple, and Philo adds that Pilate did this not so much to honor Tiberius, the Caesar, as to annoy the Jewish multitudes. The Jews sent an urgent embassy to Caesarea, where Pilate's palace was located, and appealed to Pilate to redress the infringement of their traditions caused by the shields, and not to disturb the customs which throughout all the preceding ages had been safeguarded without disturbance by kings and by emperors. Yet when Pilate, naturally inflexible, a blend of self-will and relentlessness, stubbornly refused, they clamored, "Do not arouse sedition, do not make war, do not destroy the peace, you do not honor the emperor by dishonoring ancient laws, do not take Tiberius as your pretext for outraging the nation. He does not wish any of our customs to be overthrown. If you say that he does, produce yourself an order or a letter or something of the kind, so that we may cease to pester you, and having chosen our envoys, may petition our lord," the Caesar himself. In the end, the Jews sent a letter of complaint to Tiberius, who became infuriated with his incompetent procurator and ordered him to remove the ensigns and place them in Caesarea. Toward the end of his term, Pilate also ordered the crucifixion of Jesus. To summarize, Philo defined Pilate's term as full of briberies, insults, robberies, outrages, wanton injuries, constantly repeated executions without trial, and ceaseless and supremely grievous cruelty. Seeking to quiet the tumultuous province, the Romans kept replacing procurators. Their ambition proved impossible to achieve. In 44 CE, Rome appointed Cuspius Fadus as procurator. During his time, a certain magician whose name was Theudas persuaded a great part of the people to follow him to the River Jordan, for he told them he was a prophet and that he would, by his own command, divide the river and afford them an easy passage over it. But procurator Fadus would not permit them to do this. He sent a troop of horsemen out against them, who slew many of them. They also took Theudas alive and cut off his head and carried it to Jerusalem. In response to the reckless cruelty, the Romans quickly deposed this yet another failed procurator, Fadus, and in 46 CE appointed the Alexandria-born Jew, Tiberius Julius Alexander, as procurator, in the belief that a born Jew would be welcome to the Jews. Tiberius's term, however, was just as short as the others. On the positive side, he made no alterations of the ancient Jews, of the Jews which kept the nation in tranquility, writes Josephus. On the other hand, he had no interest whatsoever in Judaism or in the Jews. In fact, he detested his native fold and was to become the worst genocidal murderer ever to emerge from the Jews. And he would perform this genocide against his own people, including his hometown. Still, during his term, he made no provocations and left in peace as he had come, seeking to advance his military career in the Roman army. Ventidius Cumanus, who succeeded Tiberius Alexander in 48 CE, was to be the procurator under whom matters began to accelerate the decline toward calamity, and the Jews' ruin came on, culminating in the great revolt that began in 66 CE and the final destruction of the temple 4 years later. Following Cumanus, the Roman Emperor Claudius appointed Marcus Antonius Felix as the procurator in Judea. Either out of hatred for Jews or simply out of indifference, Claudius appointed a freedman, a former slave, as the ruler in Judea. That was clearly a poor choice. The Roman senator and historian Tacitus writes that Antonius Felix practiced every kind of cruelty and lust, wielding the power of king with all the instincts of a slave. Josephus, on the other hand, chose to focus on those actions of Felix's time in which the Jews were concerned. Josephus dedicates chapter 13 in book 2 of the Wars of the Jews to detail the disastrous results that one incompetent procurator can inflict on a whole nation, however contentious, within just 8 years. Initially, it did not seem as though Felix's term would be so turbulent. He began by purging the country of the robber Eleazar, his accomplices, and so many criminals who plagued the country that were a multitude not to be enumerated. But the promising start soon turned out to be mere wishful thinking, as Felix's inimical attitude toward the people manifested despite his Jewish wife Drusilla of Judea. Worse than the licentiousness and abuse of power that Tacitus reported, Felix's term was fraught with violent crimes perpetrated by rogue, rebellious, and bloodthirsty groups. First, once the country has been purged of Eleazar and his lot, there sprang up another sort of robbers in Jerusalem, which were called Sicarii. The Sicarii, an extremist fringe group of zealots, were cunning dagger wielders who would stab stealthily, then sneakily join the appalled crowd protesting the stabbing. Their first victim was none other than the high priest Jonathan. But following him, many were slain every day. In this way, the Sikari spread such terror in the country that the fear men were in was more afflicting than the calamity itself. And everybody expected death every hour, as men do in war. People cannot even trust their friends. But in the midst of their suspicions and guarding of themselves, they were slain.
Just to stop here a moment, because it's not really that clear from the text here. The Sikaris, they were... They came... They were Jews, extreme Jews, that it doesn't say here, but they became a terror group. What they did was they were terrorists. This was their idea. These are the people that later besieged themselves in Masada.
Yeah, but it's written that they were extremists. The Sikari certainly earned the title First Century Terrorists that Dr. Ami Zalman gave them, or Ancient Jewish Terrorists, as Professor Richard Horsley called them. Yet they differ from contemporary terrorist organizations that act against Jews or the State of Israel in that the Sikari came from within their own fold. They were not an underground movement that sought to overthrow the government and chose violence as a means to force down the government. Rather, they sought to intimidate and physically eradicate people from their own faith, of whom they did not approve, either because they viewed them as submissive to the Romans, or for whatever other reason. The division between the zealots and the rest of the nation was the seed of the bloodbath that the people of Israel inflicted on themselves during the Great Revolt a few years later. But the diabolic assassination of the Sikari deepened the hatred and suspicion among the factions of the nation to levels that sealed the fate of the Jews. As though this were not enough, there was also another body of wicked men gotten together, continues Josephus, his harrowing description of the miseries of the Jews under the procurator Felix. This body was not so impure in their actions, but more wicked in their intentions, which laid waste to the happy state of the city, no less than did these murderers. These people pretended to be prophets and visionaries and would lead people into the wilderness, pretending that God would there show them the signals of liberty. Regrettably for them, Felix, plagued by distrust and ill will, suspected that they might be starting yet another revolt. So he sent horsemen and footmen, both armed, who destroyed a great number of them.
ורגלים שניהם חמושים והרג רבים מהם.
One of these false prophets was such a successful con artist that he got together 30,000 men that were deluded by him. He brought them all to the Mount of Olives and intended to break into Jerusalem and conquer it. As would be expected, מלווים באנשים רבים אחרים שלא היו חלק מלהקת השוטים. המאמינים של נביא השקר נלחמו בנחרצות, ובקרב הנביא...
As would be expected, Felix charged the helpless people with Roman soldiers accompanied by many other people who were not part of the fool hatred band. The result, false prophets... Believers fought back, and in the battle, the prophet ran away with a few others, while the greatest part of those that were with him were either destroyed or taken alive. Josephus compares the Jewish nation to a diseased body. He writes that when the riots over the false prophets quieted, quieted. Another part was subject to an inflammation. According to Josephus, a company of deceivers and robbers got together and persuaded the Jews to revolt and exhorted them to assert their liberty, inflicting death on those that continued in obedience to the Roman government and saying that such a willingly chose slavery ought to be forced from such desired inclinations. They parted themselves into different bodies and lay in wait up and down the country, plundered the houses of the great men, slew the men themselves, and set the village on fire till all Judea was filled with the effects of their madness. And thus the flame was every day more and more blown up till it came to a direct war. Even in Caesarea,
the procurator's own city of residence, Felix could not force order. Jews and Syrians living in Caesarea disputed over who owned the city, completely ignoring the fact that the Romans owned it and governed it. The Jews argued that the city was theirs since Herod built it, and he was a Jew. They conveniently ignored the fact that Herod was a Jew only because his grandfather was forced to convert into Judaism, and during Herod's time, even the Jews did not regard him as fully Jewish. The Syrians agreed that Herod was Jewish, but contested that it is nonetheless a fact that he did not build a Jewish city, but a Grecian city, for that he who set up statues and temples in it could not design it for Jews. Once again, the feud got out of control and came at last to arms, and the bolder sort of them marched out to fight. Finally, Felix gave up trying to discipline the rebellious factions and sent ambassadors from both sides to Emperor Nero so he would sort it out. This tactic ended the feud, but it also ended Felix's term as ruler of Judea. Porcius Festus, whom the Jewish Encyclopedia describes as more just than his predecessor, was a very short relief, relatively. Josephus writes that Festus made it his business to correct those that made disturbances in the country, so he caught the greatest part of the robbers and destroyed a great many of them. Unfortunately, Festus died while still in office, having completed a mere 2 years. Festus's successor, Lucius Albinus, summarily and wholly corrupted the little good that his predecessor had managed to do. Albinus stole, plundered, and imposed exaggerated taxes on the whole country. He released so many criminals from prison for ransom that nobody remained in the prisons but he who gave him nothing. In Jerusalem, seditions broke out as gangs of bloodthirsty criminals would buy their freedom from Albinus, while he himself, like an arch robber, made a fortune among his company and abused his authority over those about him in order to plunder those that lived quietly. As a result, concludes Josephus, nobody dared speak their minds, tyranny was tolerated, and at this time were those seeds sown which brought the city to destruction. Despite all the hardships they had suffered from the Roman procurators, and despite the belligerent sects among them, still, the Jews' patience lasted until Gisius Florus became procurator, succeeding Albinus. In his time, war began, writes Tacitus. Professor Helen K. Bond writes that Florus made Albinus appear, by comparison, a paragon of virtue. Josephus, who lived at the time when the events took place, does not settle for one sentence insinuating portrayals. He dedicated chapters 14 through 17 to describe the provocations, slaughter, plundering, and devastation that Florus inflicted on the Jews precisely in order to provoke them to rebel and start a war against Rome. In chapter 18, Josephus describes the surprise and massive pogrom that the Caesarea Grecians inflicted on the Jews. In 1 hour's time, he writes, above 20,000 Jews were killed, and all Caesarea were emptied of its Jewish inhabitants. This carnage is what Paul Johnson refers to when he writes that the revolt itself began in 66 AD, not at Jerusalem, but in Caesarea, with a pogrom in the Jewish quarter, while the Greek-speaking Roman garrison did nothing.
Adkan.
To
this point.
We'll continue so that nonetheless we'll get an impression from the book. Only we have to understand that even though that the story according to its heroes is changing, but the essence of the story between the Jews and the nations of the world does not. To the measure to which the Jews can pull themselves and the nations of the world to unity, they succeed. To the measure to which they don't, they lose. Up to the point where there is casualties. What?
I want to ask if today, when we write, we can interpret it to the parallels, we can show the parallels of today.
It's all in your hands. Obviously. So let's move on to the next part. The next part, I think, the freedom.